for this evening's performance are available at all entry points to the auditorium. Thank you.
What's Moss?
Good evening, Raymond. Your first bite of a very large Britain cherry, what do you think?
I keep thinking to myself about these 100s, you know. Was there a 100th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo? I don't think there
was.
Well,
I'm not sure there was. I think we're very much into anniversaries at the moment, though. You know, I think it's since perhaps the millennium, it sort of triggered this thought of, oh, we'll always have to celebrate birthdays and anniversaries and special events. But I'm delighted they are celebrating the Britain centenary because, you know, I think perhaps he's not underrated, but I think he's a little overlooked when people, they start thinking of great composers and the rest of it. And it's only when you prompt them, I think, that they'll say, oh yeah, Britain, yeah, he did some nice stuff there. I mean, we heard it there in the first half.
Yeah, I was surprised that we started with something so out of kilter. I mean, that's not what we think of when we think of Britain.
Yes, I mean, I suppose an obvious thing might be something like Peter Grimes, The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra or something like that. I think perhaps it's brave programming to do this. I think it's music. Perhaps, I think some people think it might be a bit flippant, but I think it's accessible, but I would certainly think of it as being still serious.
I suppose it got me thinking the other way. I was thinking less about the music and more about him. I mean, it's one of those ones where it's an interesting piece, but you're immediately thinking of the situation and the time and position in which this occurred. I mean, this is 1938. It was out 37-ish. I suppose he's writing it, but I mean, it's a response to his mother. It's response to the looming clouds of war that are on the horizon all around, and you can feel that.
Thomas, you touched on his mother there, but I think also he had just met Peter Pears at that time, I think, as well, just slightly after his mother died, I think. And there could have been, I've heard it said that Britain felt very liberated, in fact, by the death of his mother, paradoxically, you might say, and that it allowed him to become a more mature person and finally enter into a more mature type of relationship. So perhaps that's being reflected here, or am I looking for too much?
No, I felt it as well, and I think obviously they know it as well. You've got the Mahler as the second-hander here, and, you know, we all know that a lot of his desire to study under Alban Berg was really because of the love of Mahler and Schoenberg, and he ends up not going there. So really, what we might have seen, you know, if he'd gone a different route in some way, shape or form.
I suppose as well it's been put in as well, not just because Britain was influenced by him, but from a concertgoer's point of view, does it add a bit of ballast here this evening? You know, as you said, they've got that to look forward to. It's not one of his huge symphonies, but even still, I think it's got a running time of close to an hour, and it's considered to be one of his smaller works.
But I think that's the problem with Britain, is that people see him now in a strange way. From the middle 60s onwards, really after World War II, everything that you think about Britain is really moody and deep, and it's really a response to the whole of the horrors of World War II.
Yes.
Of course, famously, he was one of the first people into Belsen, and that's a revelatory experience that almost no one has had on the planet. And to have an artist there, and an artist who was rather delicate and who was, you know, very sensitive person, and quite unsure of himself, to be thrown into the middle of that, you'll see all of the rest of his work, and with certainly through the rest of the year, I think we're going to see a lot of the moodier and heavyweight pieces. But of course, he didn't start off like that, and I suppose I really like the choice here. Opening up with the piano concerto really says, look, we're dealing with a conventional musician as well. Yeah. We're dealing with a conventional composer, an ordinary scholar of music, before he becomes the kind of heroic voice of lost confidence that he is in the 60s and the 70s and up to his death.
This is, you're getting into that sort of area again, I think, where perhaps some people see him as being a bit twee and sort of safe country English. And I think it's unfair maybe to have him pigeonholed there, but perhaps, as you said there, you've got that simple, lighter stuff then, and then he indeed himself said that from his experiences of visiting and performing in Belsen, he said it influenced his music for the rest of his life, although apparently he never spoke about it until almost the end of his life. He never actually opened up to that. But I think it's good at the beginning of a series like this, where they're celebrating his centenary, that they should start with something which is pre-war and prior to that, the darkening that you referred to coming later in his work. But it's hard to know. We know now, looking back, there was a terrible war there. But, you know, as you said, you know, they didn't know looking forward what was coming.
But again, by 1938, people do know things are coming, and he's a signed-up pacifist.
Yes.
And he is writing odes to peace. He is writing about peace, and he's arguing in favour of a pacifist approach. When he comes back to Britain in the middle of 40-41, he turns up and he is trying not just to be a non-combatant soldier, but he's looking for conscientious objector status. He was heavily influenced by Bertrand Russell and others talking at the time about the idea of moving beyond war. They'd come out of the war. I mean, he grew up in a world that was scarred by the First World War and had lost a generation of young men. And there were not just philosophers like Russell, but there were competent politicians who were willing to come back and say, you know, give peace a chance.
Yes.
It was not an outrageous thing to think that people could stand on the sidelines and not be part of another European war. The war to end all wars had clearly failed in that objective. Really, I think we have to see people, anyone who was a conscientious objector or a pacifist in 38, 39, was really trying to vindicate World War One.
Yes.
Because to say, let's go ahead and have another war, let's join in, let's be gung-ho about this, was really saying that the First World War failed.
Yep.
So I think we have to see that a lot of English and European thinking at the time was along the lines of, let's give peace a chance. A lot of people at the time were considering the idea that humanity was as one is really something that we take for granted today. But it's something that was only emerging. You've got to think about the fact that, Darwinism, which is really the idea, you know, projecting the idea of humanity,
yes,
as a genus, you know, as a single entity, that's rising from the middle of the 18th century. So it's only 50, 60, 70 years old when we're in the, 1910, 1920, this idea that we're all the same. Before that, people were thinking, we're different species, the Germanic species, the Anglo-Saxon, the Celt. But really, we forget that Darwinism, which is, being picked up by most of the intellectuals of the day, by Wittgenstein, by Russell, indeed by Freud and Jung, who are talking about the universality of the mind, all of these people are discussing the idea that we are a single human entity. And then the idea that we're going to rip each other apart because of differences, which are essentially just political, was something that was abhorrent to a lot of people thinking at the time.
But wasn't it really Peter Grimes in 45 that put his name up in lights, and it still stands as a magnificent piece?
Yes, I mean, I think this is where I go back to saying, I don't overstate it.
Yeah.
The sense of Englishness, of Britishness, is amplified, I think, by this exile, choice, exile. He was not driven into it, but this chosen exile drives this inner sense of Englishness, I think. Do we get a sense of Englishness from the work tonight, Piano Concerto? I don't think there's an obvious sense of Englishness. I think it fits brilliantly into the European dynamic. But you come back with Peter Grimes, you come back with his later work, Englishness,
yes,
at its heart.
With the Alborough Festival and then the Britain Peers School for advanced musical studies, where it was Peter Peers really who would have been in charge of that, because obviously Britain died in 76. But the quality of teacher they got there was fantastic. Our own late lamented Hugh McGuire, who died there earlier this year, he was a teacher there regularly. I think he got Rostropovich along there. He got many leading people and an awful lot of a whole cohort of the performers that we know today would have spent some time there on some summer courses or whatever it might be, some short courses. And that may well be his lasting legacy, because those are the people who carry that forward. I visited Albert there a few years ago. I was actually at a wedding in the church where his funeral was held. And of course, he's buried there because that was his express wish, that he should be buried there, though he was offered a burial in Westminster Abbey. He realised that if he was buried there, he couldn't be buried beside his partner, Peter Pears, who's now in the grave beside him. And they had a memorial service in Westminster Abbey. I think the Queen Mother was the lead attendee at that. And Albert's a lovely place. There's a sense of, I don't know, there's a slight otherworldly sense. I don't want to be reading too much into it here now, but, you know, you're way out there. There's a lovely sense of peace and something there, which a slightly pastoral character as well, you know?
I think you're right. I think music is the last business. It's the last profession where people do hand down pupil to teacher, pupil to teacher. There is a lineage, and you know, I mean, obviously Berg, because he wanted to connect Schoenberg.
It's funny
through
you should say that, yes. To us, because I remember talking to John O'Connor one time, our Irish pianist, and he was able to trace back for me teacher to teacher to teacher to Beethoven.
Wow.
Came right down. It was like a family tree. About seven or eight links in the chain, you might say.
It's one of the great glories of music. And it used to be there. I mean, it was the way in which, you know, so much education was actually run.
Yes.
I mean, people would, you know, go and worship at the foot of a particular philosopher or a particular historian, but we're still doing it in music. I mean, it is still one of the beauties of it. And I suppose, in a way, it's why we can see why Mahler and Britten sit here together tonight,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
so well. By the way, I'm
really looking forward to the Mahler, are you? Because
very much so.
As a total nerd and an anorak fact, did you know that in the second movement, I think it is, the lead violinist, the leader of the orchestra, has to play on a second violin, which is tuned differently to the one they're playing on. So this sits on a chair beside them. And I remember the first time I saw this, it was a performance in the Proms in the Royal Albert Hall. And I could see, before the orchestra came out, the seating lined up, but another seat just sitting, as if somebody was going to sit and watch the leader of the orchestra really close up. But of course, he came out then with two violins. He put one down onto the chair beside him, and he has to play solos on this. And the man leading the orchestra that night, his name was Rainer Kuchel. He is the leader of the Vienna Phil, and he was explaining to me afterwards that when they're playing the Mahler 4, he will have two violins beside him, tuned the same way, because one is a spare in case he breaks a string. And of course, they all have spare violins sitting, hanging between them on the... Now, I don't expect to see all that here tonight.
But no, I agree. I mean, the practical elements in musical production are actually even more interesting in some ways than the overall score, than the overall production. And again, I suppose that's why, when you come back to Britten, it's his, you know, the other thing that he will probably be remembered for is the way in which he brought in the amateur.
Ladies and gentlemen, and the awards will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. Thank you.
I mean, there is an amateur element, a required amateur element in his music, and that's the strongest contrast here with Mahler. I mean, Mahler was not even understood in his own lifetime as a composer. He was a highly proficient and technical conductor, the absolute apogee of professionalism. Whereas Britten is the first of the decouplers. He's decoupling professionalism and trying to return it to the amateur, to music within the community in a way, mirroring on a classical level the kind of things that were going on within popular music.
Yeah. It's interesting, you touched on something there, Tomás. In fact, it applies almost to both of them, but maybe perhaps slightly in reverse, with that Mahler in his lifetime was much better known as a conductor. He really only had the summers to do intense periods of work. But of course, he was conductor of what's now the Vienna State Opera, the Hof Opera it was called then. And of course, Britten also was a very accomplished conductor, but was probably better known as a composer in his time. Mahler's work fell into something approaching, well, not total disregard in the decades after his life, and Leonard Bernstein claimed all the credit for the revival in interest in his works in the 50s and 60s, but I think maybe that he was overstating the case there a little bit. People then have to be reminded, well, you know, he really worked as a conductor rather than as a composer. We tend to think of composers, you know, in their lonely garret or whatever, you know, slaving away over the scores and so forth. But of course, they had to make a living, and it was much more regular work there in conducting and so forth.
Well, again, the other contrast you see with Britain to Mahler is that, you know, perhaps the modern world, in its own very strange way, has provided composers with a way to make a living as composers. They don't have to be conductors, and I suppose Britain marks one of the first of those because he was able to join the BBC and produce music to order. So it was back to the sort of the 18th century ideal of a very large and benign patron. When I say that Benjamin Britten is a composer, a suburban composer, I suppose in some way I'm thinking an End of Close kind of affair. Yeah. Mrs. Bouquet.
Bouquet? Surely you mean Bouquet.
Yes, I mean Mrs. Bouquet. Bouquet.
Yes,
Mrs. Bouquet,
yes.
And the son. Okay, what was the name of the son?
What was his? Was it Peregrine or...
Oh, Sheridan.
Sheridan.
That's it, Sheridan. So the son...
He never appears.
He's always, yeah, he's right, always, yeah, on the other end of the phone, yeah, and something and terrible is happening to him.
Achieving something marvellous.
He's the overachieving son that she's pushing on and on. And this is the way I see Mrs. Britten. She's got this very middle class, professional, you know, dental sort of background, yeah, the family.
But with aspirations
to be better.
Yeah.
She has, she has sons and daughters who are not interested in music.
Here's a question, yes, now. Does Mrs. Bouquet listen to Britten?
No.
What?
No. I mean, this has gone too high church for her. I mean, she is an Elgar woman to her core.
Elgar. Someone told her he was better.
Someone told her that he was more British than Britain. More British than Britain.
Now, what's that you've got there, Tomás?
Well, did you see this thing? This is quite extraordinary.
You've got coin of the realm.
Coin of the other realm across the water, Raymond. This is a 50 pence piece.
Let me see.
And it's a pretty nice one. It's basically Royal Mint, 50 pence. He's the first person, other than the Queen,
right,
to have his full name on a
really?
Coin. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you will probably say Churchill.
Well,
yeah.
I was just going to correct you there.
I could see it forming in your brain.
You know what I'm like.
I know.
But so, why not Churchill? I mean, I...
Well, there's Winston has gone on the front of it.
Oh,
so he's
I
got
see.
Benjamin Britten. It's the whole
name,
you know.
Sorry, I didn't...
If you want the 50 pence piece thought on it, the guinea's worth thought on this 50 pence piece, I would say this.
Damn.
That this is exactly what he would have wanted.
Really?
He were always promoted, you know, the people, the amateur.
Yeah.
He wanted to bring classical music to the people. And this is physically putting Benjamin Britten into the hand of the common man.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. We request that you take a seat in the auditorium immediately.